I've heard the rumors around me. They're true, but they're interesting. So I keep wondering, do I need to be right here? Or if I'm here, I need to be right here. Okay, I got it. So I'm going to kind of cheat out of the podium like this with like a cocky little tip thing. Or maybe I'll just use this. Can I just use this? Does that work? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. We'll use this one. Oh, greetings. It is so nice to be here. Do you know who that is? Oh, my gosh. This doesn't sound like it's on. Is it on?
Yeah.
It is? You can hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trusting this woman. She's my go-to audio. You'll let me know when I'm not. Okay, thank you. So this is me, adorable little me. Look at that age when you've got the baby teeth and they're just like a little precious row of seed pearls. Aren't they gorgeous? Well, my mom said I was making up stories before I could talk. She said I would be sit in the high chair for hours, and I'd be like, and your first question is naturally, why were you in the high chair for hours? I was the third child. But I kept making up stories. Here I am in fourth grade. I have four children. They all have their adult teeth now. Even my six-year-old just got them. And there's something sort of monstrous when you lose those tiny little perfect rows, and then you get like, you know, coming out every angle, like these incredible monsters. And this is the year I started to write. I got my glasses. I had my funky teeth. Had my freckles, and I had my trying to do the feathered thing with the hair. I couldn't really do it. I kept writing while I was in middle school with the braces, kept writing while I was in high school. And all this time I'm reading as well. And as I'm reading, I'm trying to figure out what a writer does, who a writer is, what do you write about. And these are the kinds of books that I'm reading. And they're almost, the books that I'm given by my English teachers in school are almost entirely written by men. Like out of, I don't know, 40 books that we read, I think maybe two were written by women. And the women in these books that the men wrote didn't feel like real women. There were lots of complex, different kinds of characters for the men. But the women were pretty much all kind of the same. They fit into certain little stereotype chunks. And this is what I'm learning about. And then as I get older, I started to think maybe the problem was not with the women, but with the writers. And then you look at someone like this and realize men are capable of writing really interesting, diverse, various kinds of women characters. So why weren't so many men doing this? And what I discovered is, as I got older, that male writers were not reading books by women. And what I really want to talk about throughout this talk is how we turn boys away from reading stories about girls and what that does. Graduated from college, eventually got my first thing published, and this was The Goose Girl. And when The Goose Girl came out, I remember talking with my editor, I skipped over years of rejections and depressing stuff, but we'll just get right into this. I remember my editor wondering, should we keep the name The Goose Girl? It was based on the fairy tale The Goose Girl. We were sort of contemplating other titles we might have. And I said, are you worried about turning off boy readers if it has girl in the title? And she said, no, we're not worried about boy readers. And I'd come to understand that I was a woman, and there's no chance that I was going to have boy readers. It didn't matter what I named my book. I was a woman, and boys were not going to read my books. I took this for granted. Even when I wrote stories about boys, I was not going to be a writer for boys. Princess Academy was my third book, and it won a Newbery Honor. And thank you. It happened like 11 years ago, but you know, I hope I get applauded for that every day for the rest of my life. I'm not gonna turn that down. Not like I did anything to do it. It was luck of the draw, but it got a Newbery Honor, and that changed something slightly in that people started to read it in classes. And, you know, I originally wasn't going to write a sequel to that. 7 years later, I wrote a sequel, and it went well. And so I think I might continue the series. Up next, Princess Academy, Fists of Satin. Princess Academy Vampires in Love, 2019. The next year will be Princess Academy Revenge of the Mountain Goat. Princess Academy Laser Eyes. I didn't see that one coming. Princess Academy The Woman Ross and Rachel Learn Safari Speed. DJ Princess Academy's Mad Bleats. Princess Academy Skin Harvest. And Princess Academy Doug. I do have three books in the series. I finished the third one. And because of the Nibiriana, because it gets taught in classes, what I found was I started to hear from teachers, and they told me the same thing over and over again, over across the years. I've heard this hundreds of times. The teacher said, when we told the class we're going to read Princess Academy, the girls went, what?
Yay!
And the boys went,
ooh.
Same thing. But once we read it, the boys liked it as much or more than the girls did. And so as I kept hearing this over and over again, I began to question this idea that I'd been told from the beginning, that boys will not like your books because they are about girls and they are by a woman. When clearly it wasn't true. I was presented again and again with evidence that it wasn't true. And nevertheless, when I did signings, it was almost entirely girls. I started to do photo essays of boys reading Princess Academy. Reading at the park, while lifting weights, at the pool with your friends, riding around town, with a mustache, up a tree, with power tools, rock climbing, with John Sheska, in the bat cave. I just wanted to show boys, it's okay, like boys do read this book, and they don't turn into a girl, or anything so horrible as it might be. Because boys are taught that girls are the most horrible things, right? This is not natural, as I've discovered, but it is very real. I wrote a book based on Ever After High characters. When I showed this slide to elementary schools, the boys, 80% of the time, began to boo, and boo loudly. And the teachers don't stop them. Now, and I just took it for years and years because it just felt like this was natural. Until finally I began to question that. Can you imagine, really, you've got a guest speaker in front of your school, and she shows you a picture of a book she's written, and half the audience feels like it's appropriate to boo her. I mean, you have to think about it, that's troubling. But boys will be boys, so they just let them boo. And finally, I started to stop it. I started to say, this is not okay for you to boo this. You're booing something because you think girls like it. And I want to tell the girls, it's not okay for people to boo things that you like. Nobody has to like the same thing. But to treat it like that, it's not okay. And what's interesting, too, is if I showed a book like this, for example, that tends to have primarily a boy audience, do the girls boo? They never do. Because we have a hierarchy of masculine and feminine. Masculine is something you reach for. Feminine is beneath it. We see it all over. If girls do something that is traditionally we consider masculine, if they pursue, for example, a STEM degree or something like that, then they're praised, right? Because they're reaching up. If a boy would like to become a nurse, that's reaching down, and we frown upon it. We even see it in simple things like names. Like there are masculine names and feminine names. And as soon as people start naming babies boy names, then they're no longer fit for boys. Think of all the names that used to be male names that once girls started using them, you can't name boys Ashley anymore, right? Or Marilyn, or Kelly, or all these names that used to be boy names, because once it's been used for a girl, it's now sullied and beneath it. This is really subtle, but it's infused in everything. One of my most recent books is called Squirrel Girl. It's based on a Marvel superhero. And she's Ryan North, who's the writer of the current writer of the Provo comics, is here this weekend. I'll be on panel from tomorrow. She's wonderful. And she started originally as a joke. Squirrel and girl, can you think of a more funny, weaker combination of things was the concept, right? How powerful could she possibly be if she's a girl with squirrel powers? It's hysterical. And then we started to examine it, and you realize, like, oh my gosh, she's so powerful. Because she, first of all, she's got, as Ryan says, she's got the powers of squirrel, which turn out to be amazing because squirrels, have you ever had squirrel menaces in your yard? Do you know the havoc that they can wreak? You're like, Terrorists have never taken down our power grid. How many times has a power grid been taken down by a squirrel? Like millions of times. And Ryan says, she's got the powers of squirrel. She also has the powers of girl. It makes me emotional a little bit. Yes, I'm crying about Squirrel Girl. Here she is, Squirrel Girl. And she's got a little friend, Tippy Toe, so my husband and I write the book. We like to really get into character there. One thing I've heard a lot people claim is that there are just more books about girls, and at least I want to say for girls, about girls. And so I'm very interested to see these graphs. This was up to 2010, about what are the genders of the protagonists in children's literature. You can see that in the 1950s, it was 80% of the protagonists were male. And now, down into 2010, it was still majority male. But isn't it interesting that our perception is there's so many books about girls, where are the books about boys? And yet it's much closer to parity. It's still majority male. It's interesting when you look at it in terms of who wrote it. So this is men. Men are writing about the same number of books starring boys as they were in the 1950s. And the real change has been in women writers who write, 60% female characters, but they're still writing 40% male characters. But that has helped bring that to parity a little closer. And if I only ever had female readers, I am fine with that. Best readers, and they are delightful and wonderful and worth writing for. And when I go and do these signings, and I find vast majority is all girls, moms and girls, groups of girls. And I ask my male writer friends who write exclusively about boys, who do you get at your signings? They get boys and girls. They get at least half girls. Because men's stories are universal and women's stories are just for girls. That's the perception. One interesting thing I found, though, when I go to these signings, they would be mostly women and girls. There'd always be one guy. And he's got a stack of my books. And when I talk to him, he's never embarrassed, he's never ashamed, and so I'm always very curious. What is different about this boy that he's escaped this somehow? And when I talk to him, what I find out, I wonder if you can guess. He's homeschooled. Something happens in the schools. And I wonder, how many are elementary school teachers? So do you know at what age this happens? Can you see it happen? Can you see it kindergarten? My 6-year-olds are very aware of boy and girl things. But they wouldn't blink twice at having they read a book about a boy or watch a movie about a boy. At what age does it start to split? Do they start to become more and more conscious of gender and not wanting to have anything to do with girls? Do you know? What?
My daughter just stopped. She's 5. She stopped wearing her Spider-Man underwear because it's for boys.
Right. And you wonder, what happened? What happened at that age where they start to do it? It's right around 5 they become super conscious of gender. And it's right around 3rd grade that if you don't get boys before then, it's almost like it's a lost cause. That's when it becomes really an emotional thing for them. We start very young. anybody in here have kids? Do you go, I don't know if it's the same in Canada as the U.S., but from day one, there are blue clothes and pink clothes, right? From the day they're born, we're already coding them. With what they wear. I remember one time I had twin babies. I was at a grocery store, and one of my girls had something pink on, and one of my girls had a binky, a pacifier, and the ribbon on it was blue. And she was wearing a little dress, and she was wearing a bow in her hair. And the woman came up to her and said, "What a cute boy!" And I said, "Oh, she's a girl." And then she said. Well, then why is she wearing blue? Like, we're always watching, and there's so many watchers, right? Men and women, kids, trying to make sure we keep those gender norms separate. But what is insidious about it is, you spot the difference in these books? The big, beautiful coloring book for girls, the big, brilliant coloring book for boys. We're telling them in very subtle ways what we expect from them. Beautiful girls coloring book, brilliant boys coloring book, how to be gorgeous, how to be clever. These onesies, smart like dad, pretty like mom. The pink one, I only date heroes. The blue one, future man of steel. This is what we're telling them. And I did some research and I found out, why is it worse now than it was before? Because it is. And it turns out in the 1980s, partly inspired by some by deregulation by the Reagan administration in the US anyway, toy manufacturers figured out they could sell twice as much stuff if they gender code it. You buy a tricycle for your first child. If you have a second child and then they're a different gender, you can't pass it down to them if it's the wrong color. You're forced to buy a separate one. You can't pass down the clothes, the toys. They're all gender coded, so you have to buy twice as much. And they figured this out, and it's so clever because it sure has worked. We have figured out how we have to get one thing for boys and one thing for girls. But again, it's not quite equal because girls can wear blue. Boys cannot wear pink because girls can reach up. Boys cannot dip down. So as this person, early in my career, because of my third book, won a big award, I was forever after dubbed the author of Princess Academy. And Princess Academy sounds very girly. Most people are surprised to find it's extremely hardcore feminist, and I've had people who've gotten PhDs in economics who told me the reason why they did was because of that book. But it sounds, the title sounds very feminine. And because of that, I have been, everywhere I've gone, I've been introduced this way. And so I have been privy to so much of this gender coding and sexism throughout my career. I'm going to just show you a few slides of things people say to me and in front of me. And these I haven't just heard once. These I've heard hundreds of times. I would buy your books for my kids, but I only have boys. No, James, let's get something else for you. Those are girl books. My son has read your book too, and he actually liked it. My son loves your book, but he's too embarrassed to say that. Why is he embarrassed? I bet you'll like this book, even though it's about a girl. I hear this a lot from really well-meaning educators and booksellers. They think they're doing a favor to the kid, to the boy. They're being brave by introducing a book about a girl, but they have to put in that caveat, and all those kids hear that so clearly. This I've gotten several times from someone introducing me into a school. Girls, you're in for a real treat. You will love Shannon Hill's books. Boys, I expect you to behave anyway. Do boys hear that message so clearly? I'm sure you've heard about the crisis in boys' reading. So why don't you write books for boys? I've gotten that so many times from interviewers. And my answer is always, I do. My sisters have read all your books. I've gotten this so many times, for some weird reason, from male authors, debut male authors, who are trying to cozy up to me and compliment me in some way. And boy, I have no patience for it anymore, so I always ask, have you? I never ask anybody. It's so impolite to ask someone if they read your book. But when guys say this to me, I say that now, and they turn beet red and they never talk to me again. I got this recently. I only have this had one time, but I got this recently from an organizer, a committee for a book festival. I pitched your name for the keynote, but the rest of the committee said, what about the boys? So we chose a male author instead. Again, because a woman only speaks to girls, and a male author speaks to everyone. I've heard this from several of my writer friends, my guy friends, after I started talking about this. For example, Adam Rex. I don't know if you know his books. Wonderful illustrator, writer, and person. And he says, when he goes to schools, what they say to him is, we're so happy to have you because you can speak to the whole school. And he never really knew what they meant before. Now he realized, oh, they mean that I speak to boys and girls. Why don't you write about boys so you can sell more books? I hear that a lot. Why do you write strong female characters? It seems like a perfectly legitimate question, one I've received dozens of times. I've never been asked, why do you write about strong male characters? Because I do write a lot of male characters. I write many, all of my books have at least half male characters. I have written male main characters. But we expect the boys to be strong. It's like they're saying, why go out of the ordinary and make girls strong when they're not actually? I mean, that's what's behind that question, isn't it? Is that what's behind it? Because I can't ever decode it enough that I get it so many times without people really thinking it through. It's like, and my answer is always, I think I write true female characters. I saw this a lot, again, with my new series, Princess in Black. Princess in Black is illustrated by Lei Wen Pham. Can I out her? She's here in this very room. wait a little bit. Be your adorable self. There she is. Yay! I want you to know her name. Some people get scared of new names, and so they don't say them at all. And Lay is pronounced, of course, as L-E, Lay. The U-Y-E-N part of her name is pronounced W-I-N. Lay Win Pham. So then you'll know what you're able to say all the time. She's illustrated 92 books, so you'll see her everywhere. Anyway, so Princess of Black. We wanted to write a story, my husband and I wrote it, about a girl. I love writing about unexpected heroes, right? A girl with a fluffy pink dress and glass slippers, and nobody would ever think she was really a superhero. But when monsters call, she turns into the Princess in Black. It was important for me in this story that she loved the princess part of herself as well. That it was not disparaging the girly, that it was like, this is a great thing to be. This is also a great thing to be. I can be both. Isn't it cool that I can be both? Life is better when I can be both. She fights monsters. Center spin, faster dash, twinkle, twinkle, little smash. It's my favorite line in the book. My husband wrote it. I'm so jealous. And the second one, she has tea parties and games with the princesses, but she always also fights monsters. I have to tell you, the mean things that people do to illustrators. So when I was writing this book, I wrote a part where they were playing hide-and-go-seek. Princess Sneezewort was not afraid of losing the game. She was afraid of never being found. And because Princess Sneezewort blended in with the wallpaper, Princess Sneezewort blended in with the table lamps, Princess Sneezewort blended in with the rug. And when you write those words, sometimes you forget to think, the illustrator's going to have to figure out how to draw that. It's so mean. But look what she did. It's so adorable. I love Princess Sneezewort. And Princess in Black and the Hungry Bunny Horde, her monster alarm goes off and when she's on her way to brunch. So she takes a detour, turns into the Princess in Black, rushes to the goat pasture. Duff the goat boy says, hurry, hurry, it's the worst monster invasion ever. She flips off her horse, ready to fight the monsters, and discovers bunnies. Look at those bunnies that she drew. Look how like one eye is slightly bigger than the other. And when you notice that, you think, there's something slightly wrong with these bunnies. You think that, you are way ahead of the story. And that's the new one, Princess in Black Takes a Vacation. In our family, we're all the Princess in Black. But what's interesting, again, with these books, this is a story about a monster-fighting ninja hero. And guess who parents give it to? Over and over again. I did a signing, like 80 moms. They all wanted me to sign it to their girls. And I would sometimes ask them, do you have boys too? They have boys the same age, but they don't even think about it. We're pre-selecting from a very young age that this is for girls because it's about a girl. Is there anything in that story that boys can't like? I get pictures from people all over with their boys dressed up as a Princess in Black. How awesome to give a boy a hero that's a girl, that he could look up to and admire a female character, and yet we can prevent it. We try to keep them from it. Well, in our family, we love superheroes of all kinds. But, of course, there's not a lot of girls in the Justice League. This feels normal to us. What is that? 9 guys and 2 women. That feels somehow balanced to us because we're so used to it. One thing I've learned with the superheroes, that's our Batman and Robin, is that boys, just like we're seeing in literature, are complex. There are many different sides to boys. There are also many different sides to girls. There are many different ways to be in the same one. We don't have to only be one kind of girl. You don't have to say, she's a tomboy. She's a lot of things. She's not just one thing. And books that allow girls to be lots of different kinds of things. We have our little Wonder Twins, too. They're getting bigger. So my husband, when we wanted to work together on our very first book we did together, he loved comic books, superheroes, and I love fairy tales. And so we decided which fairy tale character could we turn into a comic book superhero. We chose Rapunzel, and we put her in the Old West. And this is kind of a fun, for teachers, writing activity. So if you take a fairy tale, which they're great, you know, because they've got this simple structure and they're well known, and combine it with a different setting. So in this case, the Old West. And then you're going to immediately think about what's in the Old West, help them brainstorm what's in the Old West, and then how is that going to change the story? if it's Little Red Riding Hood, who's she going to meet instead of a wolf? Where is she instead of a forest? Who is she visiting instead of grandma? You know, what, who's she going to meet instead of a woodcutter? And it completely change it. For older kids, you could do genre instead of setting. So like the Western genre. With our sequel of that, Calamity Jack, the same thing we took Jack and the Beanstalk, changed the setting from a farm to a big city. And so instead of going into the clouds, climbing a beanstalk into the clouds to see the giants are big city mob bosses that live in a penthouse of a building. And the genre that we chose was caper, because Jack is a thief. So you look at the heist genre, the caper genre, and take those pieces and retell the fairy tale. You do any fairy tale, any genre or any setting. Genre's a little more harder for little kids to grasp, but the older ones can get it really easily. But my husband grew up reading these comic books, and he was told more than once that they would rot his brain. He was warned against comic books, that they were, you know, not real books, right? He went on to get a scholarship to college, and was this crazy smart and very literate, and is now a writer. So it didn't harm his brain, and he still reads comic books. But because we published Rapunzel's Revenge, which was published pretty early in at the time when we were writing it, no children's book publishers were publishing graphic novels. So this was very new territory. And I just knew because of my husband and because a lot of kids I met that these visual kinds of storytelling could hook certain readers. I've learned so much over the last 10 years about comic books and graphic novels and why they're really great. And the number one thing I get from educators is, how do we convince those people who don't believe that they're not bad, that they're okay? Because I hear from booksellers and librarians, they come into a library, sometimes teachers will say, anything but a graphic novel, or you have to pick out a real book, or parents say that when they're in a bookstore. And there's happily plenty of evidence that comics and graphic novels are actually really great for reading. I'm in a super fast, because I thought you might be interested in this, so I hope I'm not wrong, but I'm super fast just going to go through some key points that maybe you can take back with you if you're faced with any of those naysayers. First of all, this is something I hear constantly. My child never finished a book before Rapunzel's Revenge, and now he reads all the time. It's the second part of that where the magic happens. This is an educator wrote this. Parent, I can't get my son to stop reading comic books. What should I do? Teacher, repeat your first 8 words. I can't get my son to stop reading. Right? It doesn't matter what are they reading? Myth. Graphic novels are easy reading, right? Graphic novel reading is like learning a new language. Decoding words and text together is a skill. Comics encourage savoring, slow reading, and careful examination. Myth. Kids need to grow out of books with pictures. Books with pictures are books. This is a uniquely American perspective, and I don't know if Canada has the same hang-up. Europe does not. Japan does not. Different areas of the world do not. But in America, we're trying to get kids off of pictures as soon as possible because it's only for little kids. But of course, pictures aid comprehension. Pictures enrich the reading experience. It's also a celebration of art, and it's a great way to hook readers. Graphic novels prepare readers to decode the increasingly image-based information of our world. Visual literacy is becoming as important as verbal literacy. Myth, graphic novels are just for reluctant readers. This was a thing I used to think, and it's just not true. Advanced learners thrive with graphic novels. Analyzing text and picture storytelling and uses of visual medium is a highly creative exercise, and I know a lot of advanced programs use graphic novels a lot in their curriculum with great success. Non-visual thinkers, graphic novels help develop the visual imagination. Visual thinkers, it helps them practice their text reading and give a context to interpret. Oh, I got cut off story and stuff. Graphic novels are studied in concise language and how to communicate sparingly. Sorry, when it transferred to PowerPoint, it kind of wigged out some of this stuff. Anyway, another myth. Graphic novels are graphic. Did anybody else get this? Oh, when I first announced I was doing a graphic novel, I got all of these emails. I thought I could trust you. And because at the same time I announced I was doing my first adult book, I'm doing a graphic novel and I'm doing an adult book. And they were like, oh, what have you come to? I used to be able to give your books to any child and know they would be safe. And I was like, but what? And I realized they thought that I meant like adult video store? Adult book? Not like for adults? Anyway. But of course, the medium is not the content. There's as much variety in graphic novels as in prose novels. Stephen King, Beverly Cleary, and Toni Morrison all write in the same medium. It's the same thing with graphic novels. Myth graphic novels aren't real books. Comic books allow children to develop the same skills as reading a more traditional book. Connecting narratives to children's own experiences, predicting what will happen next, inference and critical thinking, tracking left to right and top to bottom, interpreting skills, following the sequence of events in a story, et cetera, et cetera. Anything you can teach about books, you can teach with comics or graphic novels. According to a 1993 study published in the Journal of Child Language, comic books or graphic novels introduce children to nearly twice as many new words as the average children's book and more than five times as many as the average child-adult conversation. Because of the illustrations, children are willing to read above their level, and they learn new vocabulary. Comic book graphic novels readers have higher vocabulary, a broader group vocabulary than people who don't. Myth, if kids read comics, they may as well be watching TV. Reading comics and graphic novels is an active experience, requiring readers to infer what happens between panels and decode the narrative density. The artist and writer communicate a tremendous amount of information in a single panel. Myth, if kids read comics, they won't want to read real books. But readers are readers. Research shows graphic novel readers are more likely to read prose novels as well than their non-graphic novel reading peers. And I found this to be certainly true. Myth, comics create finicky readers. In fact, the exact opposite is true. Graphic novel readers are adventurous. Research shows graphic novel readers are more likely to try new genre styles and kinds of books. Myth, comics are a lower form of storytelling, trashy and poor quality. Readers are able to read one full grade level higher in graphic novels than when they read prose because of the support the images provide in understanding the story. Graphic novels and manga require a complex act of literacy to read, such as reading in between the panels, and requiring readers to do a lot of work to create the story from its component parts. Seeing literary devices in comics, including flashbacks, point of view, and such played out in visual, leads readers to see more clearly the same devices used in prose literature and critique how they are used. Graphic novels help readers create both verbal and visual memory paths. I'm not saying they should be the only books kids are reading, but oh, they do so much to aid in figuring out. I have a child who cannot read a book, prose page and visualize what's going on. And she finally discovered graphic novels, and because we might have a few in the house. And once she did, she read them voraciously over and over again. And now she will pick up a prose book and read it. And now she can visualize what's going on because graphic novels help train her brain to do that. She wasn't able to do that before. Here are just some resources if you're interested. Comicsinclassroom.net, graphicclassroom.org, noflynotights.com, and blogs.slj.com/goodcomicskids. Some of you may know me from my adult books. I wrote one of my more famous ones called Ostenland. The dedication of Ostenland says, "For Colin Firth, you're a really great guy, but I'm married, so let's just be friends." And my favorite fan letter I've ever gotten was from a group of cloistered nuns who had passed it around the monastery, and they wrote me, "Even though we are espoused to Jesus Christ, the perfect man, we do have a crush on Colin Firth as Mr. Dex." Universal stories. Also, I was made into a movie starring Kerry Russell. I was on set, I co-wrote screenplay, and I was on set for the shoot. And Jane Seymour, this is me with Jane Seymour, I showed this one time to a group of kids, and they said, "Which one's you?" I just want to make sure. I've been mistaken for Jane Seymour before. I just want to make sure you're all aware of that. Anyway, I have a bunch of pictures from set because of her, because you weren't supposed to have cameras on set. But as she said, "Who's going to tell me no?" So she took all these pictures and transferred them to my computer. So this is a day on set. She's like, I would never have dreamed of risking, you know, asking the actress to take a picture with me. But she came out after a... This has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it's a funny story. She came out after a take, and she said, "This is the perfect lighting for a photos. Would anyone like a photo with me?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she's like, "Shannon, yes. Gather around, everybody. We're taking a photo with Shannon." And they just do what she says because she's Jane freaking Seymour. And so they all gather around and took a picture. And then James Callis, who's on the end there, said, let's all jump in the air and say Austinland. He was in Battlestar Galactica, if you know him, Bridget Jones's Diary. Anyway, he's wonderful. So everybody jumped in the air and said Austinland. I got to do be an extra in the ball scene. And again, Jane took this picture. And then she's like, we need a man with you. So she saw one of the actors coming up right then, and it was Ricky Whittle. Ricky Whittle's currently starring in American Gods, based on the Neil Gaiman book. And if you Google him, you can't find any pictures of him with his shirt on, because he has this terrible skin disease that he tries to put on a shirt and it just melts off of him. I've seen it live, it's amazing. And he's the sweetest guy in the world, like, hands down, the sweetest guy. And so she's like, here, come get a picture of Ricky Whittle. And so I'm just being goofy, you know, as I would do. And this is what happens when Jane Seymour starts to direct your picture. And it just kept going, and I ended up here. And when I went to England, I took my two youngest, but I left my two oldest at home with my husband, and I kept sending him pictures, and apparently she saw this and wasn't really clear what was going on. She thought I was in a wedding dress and told her preschool teacher that I went to England with another man. It's all cleared up now, I'm sure. There's no therapy needed. This is the view of my lap when I was writing the sequel to Austinland. But anyways, we're talking about books and gender. Movies are so much worse. So in 2014, and I need to update this because it's just as bad now, 88% of the protagonists in movies were male. 88% of the movies produced in the U.S. had male protagonists. And 70% of all the characters were male. 80% of the writers were male, and 93% of the directors were male. PowerPoint messed this all up. Anyway, at the top, every year I keep track of animated movies. Look at the top 10 or 15 animated movies in the U.S., and I found consistently it averages 11 male characters to 4 female characters. Not even talking about main characters, just total characters around. And even in crowd scenes, 70% of a crowd are male characters. And this reminds me of the 70% equality study, which is something that's been done several times in business and school settings, which is there's a group discussion where you've got equal numbers of men and women in a discussion. Afterwards, they ask the people, who talked more, men or women? And if women spoke 17% of the time, everyone, men and women, perceived them as having spoken equal amounts of time. And if women spoke 30% of the time, they were perceived as having dominated the conversations. So the 17% number is really intriguing to me, that's where we consider parity. We're so used to seeing so many men that even a little bit of female representation feels like parity, when in fact, of course, it's not. And kids have to be taught that that's equal. Like, when I first showed my kids Star Wars, I thought they would love Princess Leia. Instead, they were like, there was one girl in the entire movie. And one of my little girls said, when I grow up, I'm going to make a movie called Star Girls. And she was so annoyed with, she was so bored. Like, why are there so many men in space? Why are they all white? It's weird. Just another, I love data, so I just, anytime I get data, I like to include it. But Mary Rubnick Howell is a science fiction fantasy author. She went on tour recently, and she went into 14 different airport bookshops, and she counted the books. 88% of the science fiction and fantasy for sale were written by women. 18%. And then when she went back to check the numbers of how many had been published, where the publishing was, that 42% are published. So even though more men were publishing, still the men were overwhelmingly getting more representation. Airport Bookshop is a good case study because they don't take everything, right? They just take what they consider top sellers. And this is how we perpetuate that they're top sellers. How are they going to sell when they're not in the store? Why does it matter? I tell male authors, if you want to be a better writer, you've got to read books by women about women, because the stereotypes that are in stories are based on past stereotypes and previous stories instead of reality. And so you need to be reading. Women have had to learn to see the world from a male point of view as well as a female point of view. It's harder for men. Men have to do more work because they've been raised in a culture where everything is from the male point of view. The same thing with race. White people have to work harder because we see the world from a white point of view. Person of color has to see the world from a person of their color's point of view as well as from a white person's point of view. And they are better at writing white people than white people at writing people of color. That's just the truth. Also, novels create empathy. There's a great deal of evidence that changes in racial structure and class structure didn't happen until after the invention of the novel, because until the novel, people couldn't really experience something from the point of view of someone different from them, in a different situation from them. And novels, I mean, that's what they do. They create empathy, and it's so exciting. We can use them so much better than we are. Nikki Grimes wrote, "Instead of looking the other way while hatred takes root in young hearts and minds, why not try this? Plant the seeds of empathy. Teach the young to feel the heartbeats of races and cultures other than their own. Replace any possible fear of the unknown with knowledge of the knowable. Teach them the ways in which we humans are more alike than we are different. Teach them that the most important common denominator is the human heart. Start with a book. Instead of trying to prevent kids, instead of only giving them books about people like them, we have an opportunity to expand their understanding of different cultures, of different races, of different genders. That's exciting. Again, I'm seeing this already. It's my brand new book. It's called Real Friends. It's a graphic novel written by Shannon Hale and illustrated by who? Is it? Leigh McCann, you remember your name! Yay! I'll tell you a little bit about this one. Already, it's been out like a week, and I'm hearing things like this. Real Friends is definitely for girls because boys don't have friendship troubles like that. It's kind of like saying, Harry Potter is definitely for wizards because muggles don't go to school as anyone. So, Real Friends starts when I am in kindergarten. Oh, so cute. One thing about me is I have an anxiety disorder. As a kid, I didn't understand what it was. I didn't have a label for it until I was an adult. All I knew is I just felt worried and scared a lot, and I seemed to be more worried and scared than other people did, because I would hear from my family, just let it go, just relax, stop worrying, and funny enough, that doesn't actually help. When someone says, relax! You know, it's kind of like that. You're like, yeah. So I was just scared. I felt scared a lot, and I wanted to feel safe, and my mom made me feel safe, but I had to share her with 4 siblings. But when I got to school, I made a best friend. Her name was Adrienne. And I clung to her, and I loved her so much. Being a best friend was just like the best idea I'd ever had. One thing, here's one story from the book. When I was in second grade, look at those monster teeth. You know what I mean? There's just such a big difference. Look at that. Oh, it's just so adorable. And then, anyway, one day, I'm walking home from school with my best friend, Adrian, talking about how we're going to play Wonder Woman when we get to my house. These two boys come up behind us. One of them grabs me, holds my arms behind my back. The other one dips down Adrian and kisses her right on the mouth. I know. It was disgusting. And this is what I wanted to have happen. I wanted to turn into Wonder Woman. And I wanted to just wail on them. And I wanted to be powerful. Instead of, I was very scrawny and skinny and scared. And then I wanted to save Adrian and be her hero. But life doesn't really do that. Except in this case, because I kicked backward and he let go. And I took my parka that had a big metal zipper on it. And I whacked him on the head. And the metal got him on the forehead. And it hurt him enough that he fell back. And then I went after the other guy. And I started hitting him over the head with my parka. And they were scared of me, and they ran away, and I was like, the hero! And she said, stop it! And I was like, what? And she said, I wanted him to kiss me. Do you see my expression up there, top right? And I was like, wait a minute, really? And I said, but if he wanted to kiss you, he should have asked first. She says, oh. And his stupid friend had no right to grab me. I guess not. And we were still friends. She told me later, as a grown-up, that I was the first person to introduce her to feminism. And then, this is me in fourth grade. Things got tricky as time went on because I couldn't keep Adrian completely to myself. Once we were in third grade, for the first time, there was a girl in our class named Jen. And she'd been in other classes for kindergarten, first, second, but now she was in mine and Adrian's class. And there was something about her. Have you guys ever known anybody where they're just, it's just the charisma? Everybody seems to like them and just want to kind of do what they say, and they're, we say natural leader, but there's great power in that person. And so her group of friends was called the group, literally called the group. And Adrian was really pretty and smart, and so she was naturally invited to be part of the group. And these were all the cool girls in our grade. But I was me, so I wasn't really sure if I was in or out, but because Adrian was my best friend, I was kind of in, but kind of out. And it became a very stressful circumstance. If you can see in that first panel, that's Jenny whispering to Jen. And, you know, do you know that feeling? Do you remember that feeling of people whispering and kind of looking at you? And you start to think, are they talking about me? And then something changes in the dynamic with the other friends, and you think, what just happened? Did something happen? And as a kid, you don't know how to walk up to them and say, excuse me, what are you conversing about? Are you talking about me? Because I would love to be part of that conversation. Perhaps I could clear up any misunderstanding that there might have been. And then we can all be friends. I mean, you just don't have those tools. All you have is worrying and stressing about it. And I did. And Jenny was a difficult person. She lied a lot about me and just did not like me. And I felt like I was on this boat constantly. There's no steering on this boat. I had no control of it. I was just up, down, like a school. I wouldn't know if I got to school if today was going to be a day that I was going to have friends or crash. No, not today. And at home, too. Is today going to be a day when everything's okay or crash? No, today's a day my big sister's going to torment me and I'm not going to feel safe. And especially for a kid with anxiety, that's a tricky place to be in. But it is for any kid. You know, to have a family where you don't feel like, you feel kind of out of place, you're kind of the odd one out. I have friends, we say sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But they sure feel like it. Being a sensitive kid, I cried a lot. I still cry a lot, as you already saw, I cried in this presentation. it's no secret. But I didn't want them to tease me, of course, so I would run away and hide in a shrub. And sometimes when I got to this certain shrub on the playground where I would hide to cry, there would already be somebody in there crying for the same kind of thing. And it was this little peek that maybe I'm not the only one. Maybe other people are going through this too. But to answer the question of the commenters who say this book is definitely for girls because boys don't have relationship troubles like this. If we can get out of saying anything is for girls or for boys, you can definitely say this book is about girls. That is 100% true. First of all, I've already been hearing in like the 2 weeks it's been out, I'm already hearing from parents whose sons have read it because they're going through friendship troubles and it was comforting to them. When we pre-select what boys are not allowed, we have this idea that boys don't have emotional troubles, right? Boys are physical, girls are emotional. And that's a stereotype because stereotypes are often true. But they're not 100% true. And boys do feel, and telling them that they don't is so cruel, and forcing them just to kind of dig it all in and hide it. They should be allowed to feel. They should be allowed to read books about emotion. And even if they've never felt the same way as little Shannon in this book, and even if they've never had a friendship trouble, books don't always have to be about our own experience. It's great when they are. It's great to have a book that's a mirror. We need more books that are mirrors from more different kinds of experiences. Also great to have a book that's a window that can show empathy. Can you imagine boys having empathy for girls? What a beautiful idea. somebody, this is random, but somebody just asked us, what's the theme of your next book? And I don't know what my next book is, but I just kind of randomly said, girls are awesome. And all the boys went, boo! And I was like, whoa, wait, we need to unpack this. Why are you booing? When I say girls are awesome, do you hear that means that boys are not awesome? Because it's an either or, only one can be awesome? Can't boys also be awesome and girls be awesome? And I'm not good at advice, but I feel like this was pretty solid advice. I told them,
If in your life, anytime someone says girls are awesome, you say, yes, they are. Life's going to be so much easier for you. You're going to make out so much better. Just yes, they are. That's all you have to say. But stay off Reddit. Girls have very complex friendship dynamics. Boys can too. But boys care about friendship. At one of these schools I was just at with Wynn, there were these two little third graders that were going to show us to the library. One was black, one was white. They introduced themselves as Rocket and Jackson. And the other one said, Jackson and Rocket. And I said, are you friends? And they said, yes, we're friends. And the other one said, no, we're really, really, really good friends. I said, how long have you been friends? One of them said, a year. The other one said, forever. I said, are you going to be best friends forever? Yes. And he said again, we're really, really, really good friends. And I was like, Rocket and Jackson, Jackson and Rocket, you're like the coolest kids I've ever met. And friendship matters. Oh, it matters so much. It matters to boys. It matters to girls. And I think we talk about middle school and high school and some of the hard dynamics there. We forget in elementary school that there's a lot of weird social dynamics because we're figuring out at that young age how to have friends and how to have relationships. And we don't understand the pathways yet. And so there's so many mistakes. And kids can be so mean. But they're not bad kids. They're just trying to figure it out. And I did not know when my dad read this story, he said, I didn't know all this was going on. And I tried to tell him, I didn't know how to tell you. When I was a kid, I didn't know how to verbalize it. I didn't know how to explain it. I didn't have stories to compare it to, which is what I hope this book gives. It's a story to compare it to. So parents and kids could read it together, or groups could read it together and discuss it. And by discussing something at arm's length, it's easier to kind of figure out what's going on that's too close to yourself to see. I was talking about this with a wonderful librarian at one of our stops last week. And he said, that's why when I'm giving recommendations to books, to kids about books, I'll ask a boy, for example, do you mind reading a book about a girl? And then if they don't, I'll offer him a book about a girl. And he said, what's interesting is I ask the girls the same thing, and they almost never say that they mind. And I suggested, maybe don't ask that question anymore. Because by asking that question, you're giving credence to the idea that it might not be okay to like a book about a girl or like a book about a boy. Instead, quite simply, if you're offering three books to a boy that they might like, one of them's about a girl, and it's not a big deal, and we don't make a big deal about it. And this is just like a subtle way that we give them permission to read about different experiences than their own. When I was little, this is another scene from the book. I started writing when I was in fourth grade, and I had this vision of what it was going to be like when I grew up, that writing was going to solve all my problems because then people would like me. And here are my friends showing up at my signing. Shannon, would you sign my book? Wow, I could be best friends with a real author. And then my sister comes in. Shannon, you're amazing. I'm so proud to be your sister. Thank you. I am sorry I was cruel to you when we were younger. I forgive you. I thought that's what would happen. Not so much. That's not really what. Nobody actually cares. Like Facebook, nobody cares from the old days. But when I was younger and I was hurting and I was feeling alone, I desperately wanted something to make me special. And I thought, being a writer, that's what being a writer would do. Then I could be special. Or at the very least, I wanted to be really pretty, if I couldn't be special another way. Like that girl in Head of the Class that had the red hair that had really curly, and I was a redhead, and everybody always being like, why can't you look like her? And so like in my eighth grade, that's what I was trying to do. So I'd gone to get a perm, but it turns out my hair didn't perm, so I ended up just being like this fried haystack. And of course it was the 1980s, and so I wanted my bangs to be like this, like all sprayed up and beautiful. But it didn't, it just kind of went like this, and it was like hard as a rock, you know. And then I had braces on my first four teeth, but not my fang teeth, so people called me Fang. And I wished I could have owned it, and people would be like, hey, Fang, and I would have been like, yeah, Fang! But instead I was just like, ooh, you know. And that whole beauty thing didn't work out. But one thing that being a writer didn't make necessarily like solve all my problems and make me like a beautiful, gorgeous celebrity everybody loved. What surprised me about, especially being a children's author, is that it made me be part of a team that I hadn't anticipated. And it's a really cool team, like the coolest team I've ever met. it's made up of teachers. This is my my kindergarten teacher that I ran into another state when I was on book tour, which was so fun, and my fourth grade teacher, and who first started me writing, and librarians and bookstores, booksellers and readers. And part of that team, and they're not the most special member, but they're on it, are the writers. For example, I'm good friends with Brandon Mole, the writer. I'm here at his house. We love to hang out together. Libba Bray and I, we're like hiking buddies. And Linda Sue Park likes to keep me close to her. Here I am having dinner with a whole bunch of writers. This is Jackie Woodson, and she knows, Jackie knows I've always got her back. Holly Black and I could just laugh for hours. Me and Kate DiCamillo, so close. I like to eat out with Nick Kroll, James Dasher, Brandon Mole, Brian Sanderson. Sometimes I sneak on my Neil Gaiman place, you know, it's very Jessica Day George, you may know her books like Dragon Slippers and Tuesdays at the Castle. We live near each other, so we like to go for walks. Hang out. You see someone she knows. Yeah, this was a mistake. This got out of control. It all went too far. I can shoot highlights again, because that looks really nice. That's the picture that ended up in the paper, but everything's been settled now. And thank you so much for your time.